Welcome to the Review Name Podcast. I am, as always, Jordan. With me on the show tonight, we have Sam.
Hello. It's just me today.
It's just me and Sam today. And this is our final podcast of the Best of 2012 podcast series. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the best films of 2012. So stick with us throughout the hour. Sam and I are going to have a lot of fun, and hopefully you will too. Sam, why don't we go ahead and start by tossing things over to you, and we're going to talk a little bit about summer movies that we liked in 2012.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good place to start because while there were some good movies that came out early in the year, summer was, like every year, the big batch of, you know, interesting movies that are coming out, more of the big budget blockbuster stuff. And this year was a big year for summer movies with The Dark Knight Rises, the rebooted Spider-Man that was unnecessary.
And awful.
And
I really think that the best way to describe it, it wasn't really awful so much as aggressively mediocre to the point where it might as well have been awful.
Yeah, well, why don't we talk about that? Because that was a big movie, and it's a movie that's getting a sequel.
It is, and it's getting a sequel that seems to be planning to tell the story that we've also already seen with the Green Goblin.
Yeah, and I guess I've heard rumors they're bringing back Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy, and there are rumors that she's going to have to die because I think Mary Jane is being introduced in the sequel.
Yeah, I believe that's true. And I mean, I'm not a big Spider-Man guy, but I'm pretty sure that the Green Goblin killed Gwen Stacy. But it might have been, I don't know which Goblin they're doing. I think it might have been Norman Osborn, not Harry Osborn.
Well, what's kind of depressing is the best part of the rebooted Spider-Man was the chemistry that Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone had.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to kill that in the next movie.
I mean, I'd like to say I won't see it, but I probably will see it because it's me. And every time there's a big superhero movie, I see it. I saw Green Lantern, for God's sakes.
I did too, unfortunately. part of the problem is with this rebooted thing is that whenever you reboot a really popular franchise, whether it's Spider-Man or Batman, it's going to be compared to the previous batch of movies. So the Nolan movies were compared to the Tim Burton ones and the Joel Schumacher ones. And Nolan's obviously were really well received. And it was an interesting new take on the movie that was separate enough from those 90s and 80s Batman movies that, you know, people were able to appreciate both in their own way. Maybe not the Joel Schumacher ones, but certainly the Burton ones.
I maintain that Batman and Robin is absolutely a blast in that it's so goddamn awful that it's hysterical.
Well, there's that. There's the fun of that. But
I think it's one of my favorite bad movies to watch because it's just like so aggressively bad from the opening scene in which Mr. Freeze, a scientist, says, "What killed the dinosaurs? The Ice Age!" Like, right on through.
His wordplay is a thing of beauty. But to stick with Spider-Man here, of course, what was going to happen is a comparison to Sam Raimi's Spider-Man trilogy. And even though the third Spider-Man wasn't very good, those first two were really, really good. And there was something more exciting about those movies and seeing Spider-Man swing between the buildings. That seeing it in this movie, there wasn't really anything new there to me.
Yeah.
I didn't get that sense of excitement. No one had seen Spider-Man's dynamic within the skyline of New York like they had in the Sam Raimi movie, and it looked great, and they were really fun movies. They were aesthetically very different, I think, but ultimately, it proved unnecessary, I think. The dialogue kind of fell flat for me.
It didn't seem like there was enough of a new story to tell, and I don't think they needed to reboot it. You know, I don't think we needed to see Peter Parker get bit by the spider again. We already all know that. We've already seen a well-done movie with the origin story. You know, like, if the next Batman movie is like Batman Begins again, I will be upset.
I think, you know, I'm not saying, you know, no one should be able to make a Spider-Man movie anymore because Sam Raimi did it and nailed it and it's done. I mean, I feel the same way about Batman. Even though Chris Nolan had his turn and someone else will have their turn, I just think part of the backlash against Spider-Man was that it felt like it hadn't been that long since the last Spider-Man came out, so why are we doing this? And part of it was that they were going with the angle that they were going to tell the origin story again. Which I don't think people really, I don't know if there was really a desire to see that origin story again. And Batman, we hadn't really had it.
Let's get most origin story movies at this point, just because, like, either people know or they don't really care that much. An origin story wastes like a good half the movie unless it's done incredibly well.
Well, with Batman, you hadn't seen an origin story. You know, his early life was only referenced in the earlier Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher Batman movies. But Chris Nolan, he did the first one that was explicitly showing how he, you know, gained the skills to be Batman.
Right. And so I think that was great, but I don't think I need to see that done again, at least for a long time.
So while we're on the subject of Batman, why don't we talk about The Dark Knight Rises, which is another one of the super anticipated movies that came out this year. What did you think of The Dark Knight Rises, Jordan?
Yeah, well, we talked about this actually on the inaugural installment of this podcast, but I loved The Dark Knight Rises. I think I liked it more than a lot of people did. I really think that it was the perfect way to end Chris Nolan's Batman trilogy. Like, I think he wrapped up the story he was telling very well. And a lot of people nitpicked and pulled out a lot of plot holes that I think some of them are valid and some of them weren't really. I think the whole Bane and Talia al Ghul, like, how was, like, what was Bane's plan? It seems like it all falls apart. Doesn't make sense. Like, I think it all works perfectly fine if you just pay attention. And I thought it was great. It was no The Dark Knight, but it was never going to be. And if Chris Nolan had to end with his third, which I think it was a good idea too, I think this was about as good an ending as we could have seen. What about you?
I really enjoyed it as well. There were the plot holes and kind of issues I had with that, and the Talia al Ghul character, it felt very rushed at the end. She was like, oh, you're Talia al Ghul. Oh, you're dead. It was very quick that they spent time with this Talia al Ghul character, that she was a secret agent or whatever. Yeah. She was kind of hiding her identity. But I thought Tom Hardy really stepped up well, and he did a great villain. And, you know, people are going to make fun of the voice, but people make fun of, you know, the Christian Bale voice. They're always going to do that. And they made fun of the Heath Ledger voice. It kind of makes him iconic in a way. Yeah. So I think Tom Hardy did a really good job working with this kind of, it's kind of a weird villain. They're all really weird villains. I think Anne Hathaway did a really good job.
I think she was fantastic. Yeah. Yeah.
I was a little worried how they would handle that, because also Catwoman, it's a chick who dresses like a cat and flips around with a whip all the time. How will that fit into Nolan's universe? And I think he did find a way that these characters did feel like they belonged. I wasn't nuts about how Talia al Ghul was handled, but I think that came from Nolan wanting to be able to like tie everything together really well.
Yeah, I think it works. I know a lot of people don't, and I'm in the minority there.
Well, I don't think it was so pivotal. I think it kind of felt a little bit forced that he had to, you know, bring back Liam Neeson and tie in Talia al Ghul there. I don't know how necessary that was. I understand. I felt like the series would have come full circle without these little drops of the other movies in them.
I mean, I think that's true, but I feel like the existential threat that Ra's al Ghul and ultimately Talia al Ghul represented to Gotham was important enough to revisit. I mean, the idea that this place has gone so far downhill that we just need to raise it and try again, I think was a potent one. And I feel like the first movie didn't get to spend a whole lot of time on it because there was a lot of origin story stuff to deal with, and also because there was Scarecrow being underused. Which continues to be perhaps my only real flaw with the Nolan series as a whole, is he kept bringing Scarecrow back, and he kept being like, we're not really going to use him, though. But I liked the way that it circled back around, and I felt like the second time around in The Dark Knight Rises, you had all of Gotham sort of rising up and fighting for itself along with Batman, which I thought was nice.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting way to end the movie. I like tying the story of Gotham to the story of Batman, and Batman is Gotham and Gotham is Batman. I think that's kind of an interesting way to go.
I think so.
I thought that was represented well.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting about this movie that I'm sure we talked about last time and that everyone talks about is Batman's not in it a whole lot, you know? Like, I think there are two or three really big Batman set pieces, and the rest of the movie is Bruce Wayne or the other citizens of Gotham. There was not a whole lot of Batman in The Dark Knight Rises, which I thought was interesting.
probably something that people had a problem with too, though. So
yeah, I didn't have a problem with it, but I guess I can see why that would be a problem for some people. I thought it was a good movie regardless, so it didn't bother me that there was a whole
lot of time. I agree. I thought it was a good movie. It was a good capper to the series. I don't think it's going to make my top 10 of the year, but a lot of good movies that I liked a lot.
This is as good a time as any to throw out there. We are recording this podcast before either of us has finalized our top 10 list. Sam and I are both rushing through trying to see as many year-end movies as possible right now, but we have a vague idea, so we may be making references to the lists you will have read by the time this podcast comes out. And if you haven't read them, you should check them out at reviewbename.com. I'll just do that right now, so go check them out. But yeah, I don't think The Dark Knight Rises will be making my list either. It's definitely a movie that's in consideration. If I was making a top 20 list, there's a pretty good chance it would make it on there. But I do not think it will be in my top 10. That's probably a good time to segue over to a movie that you think will very possibly be in your top 10, right? The Avengers?
Yes, I was going to move on to The Avengers, and I think Avengers, it was kind of the perfect summer movie. It didn't necessarily have the weight of The Dark Knight, but it kind of gave me everything I wanted in a good superhero movie. And on top of that, it added, I think, Joss Whedon. You know, he has a great way with dialogue, and it's a lot of fun. And the way he worked, especially with Robert Downey Jr. and played with that, it was one of the most enjoyable movie-going experiences I had this year. It was impossible not to have fun in that movie. And it's one of the few movies this year that I went back to see a second time.
I actually didn't see it a second time, and I really wish I had, because, you know, anyone who listens to this podcast regularly or reads the website regularly knows that I'm a giant Joss Whedon fan. And I think he hit it out of the park. I think Avengers was awesome. And I look forward to the sequel. I think you basically said the big things I want to say about Avengers, which is it was one of the most fun movies I saw this year. I had a blast. I loved the way that Mark Ruffalo finally made the Hulk work on screen, which is something that's been bedeviling Marvel for like a decade now. So good on that. I don't know if Mark Ruffalo fronting a Hulk movie will work, but he works in the Avengers, so that was awesome.
Yeah, I think something Joss was able to tap into was how much we actually want to see the Hulk. The Hulk was kind of this big tease throughout the entire movie. And I think that helped a lot, that we didn't have to just see the Hulk in CGI the entire movie. I think there might've been some fatigue if it was just a Hulk movie. And I'm not, you know, maybe a Ruffalo Hulk movie will be really good. I don't know. But I think it was used just enough, because as superheroes go, the Hulk is not that dynamic or interesting, I think, when he's in his Hulk mode. Yeah. I think it's something that's good in like little bits, and it's something that they were able to use to comedic effect really well in the Avengers. But I don't know if he can work the same way as Batman or Iron Man or a lot of other superheroes who still have their mental faculties there, and they can form, you know, complete sentences while they're in their superhero state. I think that's kind of something unique to the Hulk.
Yeah.
Where he's kind of just this monster thing. And I don't know how appealing that is over the course of a full movie of just him.
Yeah, I don't think I'd find that all that interesting. I certainly didn't in either of the first two go-rounds with the Hulk. And I just, as a rule, I don't find the character all that fascinating. But like you said, I think they used him just exactly the right amount in Avengers. And I feel like as part of a team, it works. So I'll be happy to see him again in Avengers 2. If there is a Ruffalo Hulk movie, I'm sure I'll see it. I don't know if I'd have high hopes for it, but overall, I think Avengers was great. And I'm really happy with the way that Marvel continues to build its cinematic universe. And I hope everything continues to expand and interlock the way that it has been, because I feel like one of the things that Marvel does very well in comics and now in movies is make their universe feel like it's cohesive, like everything ties together really well, mm-hmm. in a way that DC Universe doesn't really, and I'm wondering how Justice League is going to work, but that's something for another podcast. For now, I think Avengers was great.
I agree with you.
Were there other big summer movies you wanted to talk about?
I think those were the big ones for me. What other, I mean, I guess we kind of covered the superhero. I think, what else was there over the summer?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of big summer movies. We really should have made a list of these.
Yes, I think wasn't 21 Jump Street, wasn't that a summer movie?
That was like March.
Was it a smarch movie?
It was a smarch movie. And it was okay. I give it a resounding okay.
Trying to think. Brave?
Was I Brave thought Brave summer? Was fairly disappointing.
I thought Brave was fairly disappointing too, unfortunately.
Whatever, I'm sure they'll get it next time, Pixar.
I always have faith in Pixar. I'm sure they'll be fine, unless they make another 10 Cars movies.
Which they will, probably.
Probably, they're very, very profitable. But I think going forward, you know, Jordan and I, we've both been kind of putting together our top 10 lists, and we have kind of a rough idea of what's going to be on there. So I think maybe we should go back and forth and try to see things that are on both of our lists so we can talk about them a little bit.
Sure.
I'm thinking of starting, how about with Moonrise Kingdom? Because I know you've seen Wes Anderson's latest installment.
I have. In fact, I believe we saw it together.
I think we did. That was when you were in New York.
It was.
It was too brief a time, Jordan.
Far too brief a time. Law school continues to be a thing.
Damn your schooling. So what did you think of Moonrise Kingdom? I know you're already a giant Wes Anderson fan.
Yeah, I'm a huge Wes Anderson fan, so I was predisposed to like Moonrise Kingdom, and a lot of people give Wes Anderson flack for making the same movie, quote-unquote, and I think that's not necessarily invalid. I just think he makes a good movie, so, you know, if he plays with the same stylistic elements and the same thematic ideas again and again, and they keep being good movies, I don't really have a problem with that. That being said, I don't think that Moonrise Kingdom was one of my favorite Wes Anderson movies. It's definitely something that's going to be in heavy consideration for my list. I believe in the rough and tumble version that I made before this podcast, just to see where I was standing, and so we could sort of talk about a list, even though I don't have one yet. It is on there, but I don't know. I still have to see several more things, and I don't know if it's going to end up staying on there. I thought it was good, but probably in the lower half of my, if I were to make a list of Anderson movies that I liked. And I think it was because of the nature of the story he was telling, which I think he told very well. And I mean, Moonrise Kingdom was at heart a kid's movie. You know, it was a movie about children.
But I don't think I'd call it a kid's movie.
Well,
though.
Not a kid's movie. A movie about kids is what I meant to
say. I thought of it as kind of like a coming-of-age movie.
Yeah, I think that's a better way to put it. And I think, as a result, a lot of the adult characters didn't get a lot of screen time and didn't get a lot of development. So everyone felt a little shallow to me, except for the main two characters, obviously, who were very well-developed. And that was a bit problematic, because usually what I love about Wes Anderson movies, one of the things, is how well he develops an ensemble and how everyone seems to get their own moment to shine. And I didn't really feel like that was as true here. That being said, I thought Moonrise Kingdom was great. Obviously, it had a great soundtrack. Both of the leads were great, which is, you know, not necessarily a given when you have children starring in your movie. But they were both fantastic. And ultimately, I thought it was just a really solid movie. What about you?
I mean, I'd agree that this wasn't an ensemble piece such as The Royal Tenenbaums, but I think this really was supposed to be a more focused movie about these two kids who it's this kind of love story and a coming of age story at the same time, and they're dealing with their adults. I think it made sense that the adults were kind of on the periphery and they were kind of dealing with more adult things. So that I didn't really mind that they weren't as much of a focal point of the story. It kind of gave it, I think, more of a child-centric view of the world, in that the adults are kind of dealing with this adult thing, and they're mm-hmm. worrying about their kids. And we're more focused with the more important story of Sam and Susie Bishop. So I think it worked extremely well, and I think it's probably going to end up making my top 10 list, probably on the bottom half. But I certainly enjoyed this more than I liked Darjeeling Limited, which I thought was pretty good, but not great.
Yeah, I would say it was better than Darjeeling, and possibly better than Bottle Rocket, which, depending on when you catch me, I have varying opinions on. But probably I liked every other Anderson movie better. I like Fantastic Mr. Fox more. I like Rushmore more. Obviously, Life Aquatic and Royal Tenenbaums, one of which was on my... Royal Tenenbaums was on my top 10 movies of the last decade. Life Aquatic was literally number 11. So, clearly I love those movies. But I think it was a very good movie. It was, you know, it was not a misstep or anything. And I agree with you that it was supposed to be focused. I think I lost a little bit of something in that hyper focus that I like about Anderson's movies. But I thought he told the story very well.
Yeah, and I think he told it with his typical humor and, of course, his style. And I think, you know, maybe some people aren't so into that, and that's fine. But he's kind of unapologetically himself in terms of his style. He's, you know, you're gonna be able to look at one of his movies and know it's him. Yeah. And I think he did an excellent job. Like you said, when you got the two protagonists of a movie and they're both young actors, he got really good performances out of both of them. So,
oh yeah,
I think he should certainly be commended for that. And
absolutely. And yeah, they were both incredible. Really most of the kid, like, I don't think there was a moment in that movie with even any of the ancillary kids that I was like, wow, that's just a terrible line reading or a terrible performance. Which is incredibly rare when you have a movie full of kids like this one is.
Yeah, and so I think he really captured kind of the how a kid's view of the world, to them it's something much more serious than something from an adult's perspective, that this isn't that big of a deal. This is kind of young love. That these two kids are so earnest and that they take everything in their lives so seriously. It's like they were living in the wilderness and this was life or death, and their relationship was the last relationship on earth, and that their love was so important. It was kind of nice seeing that perspective, and I think Anderson did a great job capturing that.
Yeah, I agree. So we can move on now. Why don't we talk about, why don't we talk about Silver Linings Playbook?
Sure. Silver Linings Playbook came out a little bit more recently. I guess technically Moonrise Kingdom could be in our summer movies. I think that was in May or June.
Yeah. But we've grouped it more in our prestige section, I think. Because
let's call it the prestige section, or the not comedy or superhero movie section, which is a shame. But
I mean, Silver Linings Playbook was sort of a comedy. It was a David O. Russell comedy.
You know, in a different year, if one of the better Pixar movies were around, they might be near the tippy top of my list. But it just so happened that I went the predictable, normal drama route.
Yeah, I mean, in any given year, Pixar is always in consideration. You know, whatever movie they put out is always going to be in consideration. Brave was one of my least favorite Pixar movies, so it will not be making my list. But, I mean, virtually every other Pixar movie is on or near the top, or on my list or near my list. So, they just continue to knock it out of the park. But, yeah, this year, a lot of the stuff near the top of my list is pretty much just dramas. In fact, looking at my list now, it's virtually all dramas.
So yeah, I mean, it depends how you...
Before we jump to Silver Linings, were there any comedies that I should be considering for my list? Let me look at this. Are there any comedies you can think of that were particularly great this year?
Besides Silver Linings Playbook, which is...
Besides Silver Linings, which we're going to talk about in a minute.
I
guess Bernie was a comedy.
I haven't seen Bernie, but I've heard great things about that. I honestly think it was not a great year for comedy.
It wasn't. I'm
Seven
looking at my list now.
Was an okay comedy. You know, it's kind of
a
dark comedy.
I tried so hard to see that, and I haven't seen Seven Psychopaths.
But yeah, thinking about it, on my kind of bigger list of movies that I saw this year, the comedies, Seven Psychopaths, 21 Jump Street, Men in Black 3, which I really didn't like, Wanderlust, which I was a little bit disappointed in.
Yeah, Wanderlust was resolutely okay. Men in Black 3 was not that great.
I don't think it was a fantastic year for comedy. I mean, Moonrise Kingdom was a comedy, I think.
Moonrise Kingdom, Silver Linings Playbook are both comedies that are very possibly going to make my list. There are funny moments in some other movies, but I wouldn't call any of the rest of them probably comedies. Bernie is something that's in consideration for my list, so if that makes it, I'll have at least one comedy on there. Although it's a darker comedy.
Yeah. Well, probably my favorite comedy of the year had to be Michael Haneke's Amour, which was just a laugh riot.
That's one that I'm going to try to cram in before my list deadline.
About the deterioration of our bodies and the inevitability of death. Yes. But yeah, actually, overall, I think it wasn't a really great year for comedy.
I would agree. So why don't we talk about Silver Linings Playbook?
A comedy I think we both liked. And
I thought it was great. But why don't you go first and tell us.
I like Silver Linings Playbook for a number of reasons. One, Bradley Cooper showed me that he can do more than just play a smarmy asshole, which is kind of what he was making his bread and butter on. And I expected not to really like this guy in this movie, and I actually really grew to like his character a lot. Jennifer Lawrence, I kind of assumed she would be good, and she was. She did a really great job. And she's kind of quickly becoming a go-to, you know, she's going to give a great performance type actress. Kind of how I think of older actresses like Kate Winslet or Kate Blanchett, even though they've done kind of a little bit more prestige-y stuff, and she's still doing the younger, more blockbuster-y stuff like Hunger Games. But I think...
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, I saw Hunger Games earlier this year, and I did not particularly like the movie, but I thought she was incredible in it.
I liked Hunger Games. I thought it was a solid
action movie. I thought she gave a great performance in a movie that otherwise was just... Maybe it's because I saw it after having recently rewatched Battle Royale, and I was just like, wow, this is just not as good as Battle Royale.
Well, yeah, if you're going to compare the two. But in this movie, I think, you know, the heart of the movie, of course, is their relationship, and I thought they were both incredibly charming. And beyond that, what really, you know, pushed the movie over the edge was, I think, it had elements of romantic comedy, but it was also a really good sports movie in a way with this dance competition that they have to get. It's like a very arbitrary competition that involves gambling. It's all very arbitrary stuff, but I think it worked really well. And
yeah, it raised the stakes very well.
It raised the stakes.
I wasn't expecting that.
And it, you know, nothing was life or death, but it was all around this central love story, and about two people kind of trying to cope and to treat various degrees of mental illness. I think there has been a lot of criticism of how the movie is kind of making mental illness kind of cutesy, and oh, it's this thing that can be cured with the power of dance. But I think it's also shown that, you know, Bradley Cooper's character he's in treatment, and people seem to forget that. They're like, oh, he's healed from dancing with Jennifer Lawrence, but they also show in a montage that he's taking his pills again, right, which I think is something that's more important. No, maybe dancing with Jennifer Lawrence isn't going to heal him, but maybe being in a sort of not committed, kind of committed relationship with somebody that also forces him to make himself better. Maybe that's forcing him to take steps to take his pills and you know, have a goal towards something and have a strict regimen on doing something that can make him a better person.
I didn't have any problems with the way the movie depicted the mental illness. And I think I would have if it had been like, oh, like love cures crazies. But I actually think that the movie did a very good job of showing, like, Bradley Cooper's not okay. You know, throughout the movie there, he has, you know, manic episodes, and he is, you know, he's freaking out. And it's like, there are some very intense scenes in the movie where he's just, you know, he's manic and he's screaming at his parents, and, you know, he accidentally injures his mother at one point. And it's clear throughout the movie that he has a mental problem, and he's getting treatment for it, and eventually he's medicated for it. And also, you know, Jennifer Lawrence's character does a good job of helping him cope with it, I think. It's not like, oh, like, he fell in love and now everything's okay, but he starts to develop strategies to deal with his illness. And I think that was done very realistically.
I think part of something that people didn't enjoy maybe was the ending was kind of a very pristine picture of this relationship. But I kind of took it in a different way, that things are going really well now, but both of these people are on such like a long track that you don't really know where their relationship is going to go, and you don't know how okay they're going to be for the near future. But at least right now, in this moment, they're doing well because they have the help of each other, which I thought was really great.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't cure bipolar, you know. Bradley Cooper will always be mentally ill, and they never really made clear if Jennifer Lawrence, or what Jennifer Lawrence's mental problems were outside of her depression after her husband had died. But it's clear she had some problems as well, and I imagine they're not magically going to go away. So I don't think the movie never gave me the idea that these two are going to be together forever and all their problems are solved. I think it just ended with like, well, they're good for each other. They help each other out. They make each other better. They make each other want to be better, and that's good.
Yeah.
I think neither of us has mentioned yet, and I think we'd be remiss if we did not mention how great Robert De Niro is in this movie. Because it's been a very long time since De Niro got to give a performance that I think was really great. You know, he's done sort of the fluffy comedies for a while, and the, like, really, really bad cop movies where he just kind of, like, says his lines for a while. I thought he was really great in this movie.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think Robert De Niro is going to net a supporting actor nominee.
If he did, I think he would deserve it.
Yeah, that actually just, it made me so happy to see him really digging into a really good role and making it really great. He played Bradley Cooper's father, who also, he's obsessive compulsive, and he's a, I'm not going to say degenerate gambler, but he is a gambler.
It was borderline degenerate there.
It was touch and go there, but
that was another thing that I thought the movie did a really good job with is develop. Like, it's clear that De Niro's character has mental issues as well, and Bradley Cooper throughout the movie is like, look, it's not just me. Like, you also have these problems, and you're just not dealing with them. And I thought that, you know, at the end of the movie, they kind of did a little bit with like maybe things are going to go on a better track, but not really. Like, it's clear De Niro is still going to have problems.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really glad to see him doing a movie where he's not.
It's good to see him flex his acting muscles.
Well, again. It's not just something where, oh, he's doing this for the paycheck. He really did a great job in this role, and I'm happy to see a good Robert De Niro performance, because I honestly can't remember the last one that I thought was really great. So here's to more of these type of performances from Robert De Niro and from Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, because they all did an excellent job.
Everyone across the board was great. And Bradley Cooper is someone who I actually think I would have a bias against, if anything. I really thought, well, as long as Bradley Cooper doesn't ruin this movie, then it's probably going to be really good. And I thought he was very good. It was a great performance. So kudos to him, because I would be the first to criticize him. I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah, just to kind of transition to another movie, and speaking of grudges against certain people who proved us wrong, I'm kind of notoriously hating on Steven Spielberg for various things, often things being too saccharine or wide-eyed and sweet, though Steven Spielberg has a great, you know, a great catalog of movies he's directed. Some of them bug me a lot. But this year with Lincoln, he put the cynical Sam away, and I really enjoyed this movie. Daniel Day-Lewis, he gave an excellent performance, and all I can think about was during Lincoln was how this is kind of Civil War era version of The West Wing, where it was a very talky movie. It was very much like a play, and that might be because Tony Kushner wrote the screenplay, but it's not necessarily a bombastic movie where it's about Daniel Day-Lewis giving big speeches and screaming at everybody. It is a more subdued movie and more about conversations in back rooms about getting this amendment passed. And I thought Steven Spielberg found a way to really bring this to life and make it palatable. Honestly, I don't know how interesting the subject matter would have been if it hadn't been in such great directing hands or with such a great writer like Tony Kushner. And I also think Tommy Lee Jones, like Robert De Niro, had an absolutely fantastic performance, and he's going to get himself a nomination probably.
Oh, he's going to get himself nominated.
I think he kind of stole the movie from Daniel Day-Lewis in a lot of ways, though. I wouldn't
go that far.
I wouldn't be surprised, honestly. I mean, of course, Daniel Day-Lewis is going to get a ton of award recognition for this. But Daniel Day-Lewis, I don't think he didn't blow me away like he blew me away with There Will Be Blood.
I wouldn't say this was better performance-wise than There Will Be Blood, although that is probably one of my all-time favorite film performances, so that would be hard to do. But I think he was incredible. And I was thinking to myself after the movie, like, he just does not give bad performances. I think he's pretty much across the board incredible in every movie. I can't think of a Daniel Day-Lewis movie that I've seen that he wasn't incredible in, even if though some of his movies are not very good. I thought he was great. Sally Field was awesome.
Sally Field turned the crazy on. Did a good job.
Basically, my thoughts on it walking out of the movie, and as I've been thinking about it, I saw it yesterday, so I haven't been thinking about it for all that long, but as I've been thinking about it, I don't know that the directing really blew me away, and if anything, I think the screenplay did a decent job. I had the problems with the historical inaccuracies, as I know everyone else did, or at least a lot of people did. That bugged me a little bit, though it didn't ruin the movie for me by any stretch, and a lot of the moments the big moments seemed as if they were being slightly, I can't say overwritten because they were huge, like, America's great moments, but there was a hint that this movie knew how important it was a lot of the time that I didn't necessarily, I don't think I necessarily enjoyed that aspect of it, where I felt like Spielberg and Kushner were like, we're making a masterpiece right now and everyone should just sit back and enjoy that fact. So from a writing and directing standpoint, I think sometimes the movie went a little bit overboard, but acting across the board, it was well acted. Like, I can't think of someone who was less than awesome in the entire movie, I think. Like, every character was well acted.
Yeah, I think James Spader, John Hawkes gave great performances.
Tim Blake Nelson was great in it. You had Jared Harris playing Ulysses S. Grant, which was awesome.
Yes.
It has been Holbrook.
I gotta say, it's been a good movie for... It's been a good year, rather, for television actors being in movies.
Yes, definitely.
Especially with Zero Dark Thirty, which we're going to talk about in a middle, which I think has every television actor who's ever been in any great television show.
Humorously, actually, we can probably transition, unless you have things you want to keep talking about with Lincoln.
I wanted just some issues I had with Lincoln. I thought... spoiler alert, at the end, Lincoln is shot and killed. That coda in the movie felt so rushed and tacked on. The movie could have ended before that. Everyone knows how Lincoln's story kind of concludes.
I didn't know for a fact going in that they did depict the assassination.
I didn't know that either.
They didn't really depict the assassination. Another spoiler, I guess. Much as they depicted Lincoln dying after the assassination. Yeah. But I think I would have enjoyed it more if they had just not done it, because the movie, it was not about that, you know? It wasn't really even about Lincoln. It was about the 13th Amendment, which I guess is probably not a very good name for a movie. But I did not need Lincoln to die, and I definitely didn't need the like schmaltzy flashback to his second inaugural speech.
Yeah, it felt incredibly rushed after a movie that I felt took its time and was deliberate enough to do the story justice. And then this ending felt so tacked on and quick. I didn't need it. And also something I wasn't a huge fan of, and I might have to dip into an old Spielberg criticism, but the Joseph Gordon-Levitt storyline as Robert Todd Lincoln was really not, I don't think, served particularly well. There was a lot of father-son tension, which, as you can imagine, Steven Spielberg was probably frothing at the mouth to cover. I honestly don't think that it needed to be as big of an issue in the movie, though I can understand the choice to put it in there, because maybe you want to show all these things are happening to this one man at the same time while he has to deal with this.
I mean, it was going to be in there because it's Spielberg, but I actually think it makes sense because, you know, Lincoln has the dead child, and he clearly has a closer relationship with his younger son, Tab, than he does with Robert. So I think I think they did a good job with the fact that it was like a subplot in the movie, with the idea that Lincoln has, you know, he's not the best father necessarily. He has problems as a father. And I also like the moment that reminds me, because a lot of this is like, look at how white men saved black people, which is problematic, obviously, and which bugged me. But I did like the moment with between Lincoln and, I guess she's his housekeeper, where he kind of comes to say, like, look, I don't know you people, and he does, it's pretty much a you people moment. Like, I don't know you people, I don't know your concerns, and I don't really care about them all that much. I think, you know, I'm more focused on getting freedom for everybody. It's not, you know... It was sort of like Lincoln was not a saint. Lincoln was not necessarily, as progressive racially as people tend to think he was. And in a movie that could have used a lot more of that and a lot more of the other aspects of the 13th Amendment, and hey, maybe some Frederick Douglass even, would have been nice. But I liked that moment. So I think there were a few really good, like, Lincoln was not perfect moments in the movie. Perhaps not enough, but... I didn't have as big a problem with the subplot as you did, although it was kind of shoehorned in at times, and it basically required Joseph Gordon-Levitt to just be like, Dad, for like a whole
time. I want to fight in the war. Why won't you let me fight?
I just want to go to the war.
He was stupid to want to go to that war. Everybody died.
Yeah.
So I guess we should transition now to another movie Jordan, which movie do you want to talk about next?
Yeah, I had a transition in mind when I said, "Oh, we're ready to transition," and I don't remember what it was now. Why don't we move into, well, Zero Dark Thirty is what we're going to talk about next.
Okay, because we're talking.
We should probably
about...
move into what I think is going to be the top of our lists because we're getting on in time now, and we don't want this podcast to be 7 hours long.
Just 6 hours.
So why don't we talk about Zero Dark Thirty? What did you think of that, Sam?
Yeah, Zero Dark Thirty is a movie I think is definitely going to be in my top five, and. Well, I don't think Lincoln is going to be in my top five. Something that I think both movies have in common is they both have a very, very, very famous event at the conclusion of each of their stories. But I think they are both what makes them so great, I think, is that they're both able to pull out such great suspense and drama from each situation. You know, the cynic in us can go, "Oh, I think they're going to kill Osama bin Laden at the end of this movie." But Catherine Bigelow does a great job at recreating this thing that everyone has kind of heard about, and we know pieces of information about it. But until you see it on the screen and until you see it actually unfolding, it feels like you're watching it, because that's the closest we're ever going to get. And I think at a certain point in Zero Dark Thirty, specifically when they're raiding the compound that Osama bin Laden is in, it's almost a silent movie. There's so little dialogue. It's complete silence. And I think everyone in the theater I was in with while they were watching this movie were incredibly tense.
Oh, yeah.
About. And Jessica Chastain gave such a great performance. And she's another person who's just going to be... She's like going to be like a superstar now.
She's just reliably great in every movie. And she came out of... virtually nowhere last year, and was in like 4 or 5 movies, and was great in all of them, and has been great. She was great in Lawless this year, which is a very good movie that probably won't make my list, and we're probably not going to talk about here, but she was very good in it, and she was great in Zero Dark Thirty.
Yeah, all I can think about, unfortunately, a lot of what I was thinking about during this movie was Homeland. I don't know if you were thinking about it too, but...
Oh, of course.
The heroines centered around protecting the homeland and national security.
Really there's a lot of similarities. They're both very obsessive with their target. Clearly Carrie's target on Homeland, the Abu Nazir character is as heavily based on Osama bin Laden as you could possibly be. You know, there are a lot of similarities there, but that's probably a topic for another podcast.
But I thought
Zero Dark Thirty was fantastic.
I agree. I think Zero Dark Thirty, unlike Homeland, was able, you know, of course, because it's based on a true story, it was able to remain grounded. And her obsession over this mission and this one tip that she gets and she has to follow through on.
For years.
For years.
Like 8 years that she's following, she's looking for Abu Ahmed.
Yeah. It had such great scope, and this movie does take place over the course of many, many years, and there was such a sense of release at the end of the movie.
But
because
not,
it did feel
I,
like such
what
a
I
great
liked
release.
Is it was not really triumph, you know? It wasn't a big, like, flag-waving, like, we got him moment.
No.
It was more like, we went to some really dark places to get this done, and I don't know if... I think the movie ended... I was curious where it was going to end throughout. I was like, I don't know exactly how this is going to... You know, obviously I know what's going to happen at the end, but I don't know how it's going to tie up. And I think how it ended, which... Obviously, if you're still listening, I'm about to spoil the exact ending of the movie.
Oh, well, so. You don't need to spoil the ending.
Okay, well, fine, I won't then. But I thought how it ended was very good. And I thought it did a good job of saying, like, there was a lot of weight to the proceedings in terms of, like, things got dark for a while there. And, you know, the people involved in it and the country as a whole will probably not be the same afterwards. And was it worth it?
Yeah, something I was thinking about this movie was I loved The Hurt Locker so much, and I'm wondering now if Catherine Bigelow, is she gonna be locked into these Iraq era war movies? Is this gonna be her thing?
I kind of hope not. Although I loved The Hurt Locker and I loved the Zero Dark Thirty, so I guess if she keeps making great Iraq era war movies, that's fine with me. But I think she's capable of making a lot more and doing a lot of different stuff. Obviously, we've seen in the past Point Break, Strange Days. Like, she's made a lot of very different, very good movies. And basically, she's a great director, and I'll see whatever she does. But If it's another war movie next, I would probably be a little less excited than if it was something drastically different. Just because we know, like, we know she's capable of doing virtually anything. You know, I guess she usually does action movies, so it'll probably be another action-y type of movie. Although, I wouldn't call either The Hurt Locker or Zero Dark Thirty an action movie.
No, I really felt they were both kind of suspense movies, more so than action movies.
Good God, both of them do have, I wouldn't say necessarily an action, but a suspense set piece. That obviously the raid in Zero Dark Thirty and the sniper scene in The Hurt Locker that is just like so intense and so perfectly orchestrated and well directed that it's, I mean, it really, if I hadn't been as tense as I was during the raid scene, I think my jaw would have dropped with how well it was directed. And I think I've read some places where they were criticizing the use of the night vision, the green night vision view, and I thought it worked excellently. Really, I think that whole sequence was just phenomenally well directed, and done about as well as I could possibly imagine it being done on the screen.
Yeah, it was really a fantastic job by her, and a great job all around from this cast, which was really excellent. And Jessica Chastain, you know, she did a great job leading
it's her
a strong
movie,
class.
Really, like everyone else is a way, way, way supporting player compared to her.
Yeah, of course we have to give credit to all the television people who were in this. Kyle Chandler from Friday Night Lights, Harold Perrineau, who was in Lost and Oz.
Chris Pratt from Parks and Rec.
Chris Pratt, who gave the most surprising performance, I think, just because all I can think was, why is Andy Dwyer holding a machine gun?
Yeah.
And why is he competent?
I hope there's an outtake somewhere where he's acting as goofy as he usually is on the set of Zero Dark Thirty.
Also,
Mark Duplass from The League.
Yes, Mark Duplass from The League. And my favorite cameo, which I didn't expect, was John Barrowman from Dr.
Yeah, that
from
was
Dr.
so Who. Weird. John Barrowman. And well, what was strange to me, I saw Zero Dark Thirty and Not Fade Away as a double feature, and I saw Not Fade Away first. And so I did not know Gandolfini was in Zero Dark Thirty, but he is very prominently in Not Fade Away. And so I was like, wow, okay, so I just did a James Gandolfini double feature that I didn't realize. But I thought he was very good in a very small role.
Yeah, he actually did a great job. I mean, he was kind of playing an oaf, which,
yeah.
But this was a coup for television actors, which I was really happy to see. And of course we're now always going to look forward to the next Kathryn Bigelow movie. She's fantastic. And
she's on goddamn quite a run.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, The Hurt Locker was my number two favorite movie in 2009, and I probably would make it number one if I was remaking that list.
Yeah, I think I had that at number one for me that year.
A Serious Man edged it out in 2009, which is a movie I love, but I think it would be my number one movie 2009 were I rewriting that list now.
I think it was 2008.
No, it was 2009.
I'm looking at IMDb and it says 2008, October. IMDb Maybe it came out in somewhere else in 2008.
It was definitely 2009, because I remember A Serious Man as well. You're a madman.
I'm looking at IMDb.
Well, my number one movie of 2008 was The Dark Knight, though.
Well, Serious Man was 2009. Maybe it just came out somewhere else in 2008.
Yeah, it came out in 2009, because, yeah, no, I am positive. Well, Zero Dark Thirty, great. Why don't we transition to another one of the movies that I think is going to be close to the top of both of our lists? Why don't we talk about Holy Motors?
Sure, Holy Motors. How are we going to talk about Holy Motors?
The problem with Holy Motors, and I think this is the only problem with Holy Motors, is that it's very hard to explain to anyone and very hard to sell. And also, I don't know how much people who aren't giant film geeks would love it, you know? Like, I can't imagine sitting down with my parents and watching Holy Motors and them thinking anything, but, like, that was insane. But I thought it was fantastic. I guess if I have to try to pitch the premise to our listeners, it's about a man who... How am I... Sam, can you do this better than I can?
Well, it is. It's about a man. Basically, we're introduced to this man who rides around in a limo. I'll give you the quick and dirty of what it is. He rides around in a limo, and he basically has a folder full of assignments where he has to play different characters in movies, but he doesn't go to film sets. He just goes into the world and inhabits these characters. And it's almost like a collection of short films, but there's this connectedness that comes from the character of the actor who is traveling around to all these different things, and it's very strange, but I felt it was kind of it was a type of movie you kind of just sit back and you let it just happen to you. It's absolutely unpredictable and fascinating and beautiful and strange.
It was funny. It was dramatic. It had a weird cumulative weight because you say it was like watching several short films, and to a large extent it was, and that's how I would pitch it to someone. But it didn't really feel like that because the character of the actor is so strong, and he just, there's a tragedy to the life that he leads.
Well, he's kind of in bondage. He's kind of just a slave to this.
Right. And like all he does is go to the next role, go to the next role, go to the next role. And even seems like the end of his day is to go to a role that he will play for that evening, and it does a very good job of giving him weight, but it's also, it's a movie about the death of cinema in a lot of ways. And I think that's something that appeals to a lot of cinema geeks that might not to the rest of the world, but I thought it was beautifully done and just, yeah, it's a weird, funny, heartwarming, heartbreaking, great movie.
It is everything, this movie, and you're probably gonna see it on a lot of top lists just because it's so unique. It's one of the most interesting movies I've seen in a long time. I'm not sure if it's gonna be my favorite movie of the year, but it's certainly gonna be up there.
It's certainly going to be high on my list, and ultimately I think this is a year where the top of my list is gonna be fairly interchangeable. Not to say that the movies up there aren't great, but I'm not sure where they're going to fall yet, and I'm not sure even when I make the final list that it'll be exactly right, The space between number 2 and 3, for example, probably won't be all that large.
I mean, it's part of the reason why I hate doing top 10 lists, because why do I need to pick a winner,
Well, it's a moment in time. Like I said, I think my 2009 list would be very different. Was it 2009 that was White Ribbon, and I didn't get to see it until January of 2010, I think.
Yeah.
And White Ribbon might have been, I think The Hurt Locker was still the number one, but White Ribbon would have been right up there. The year after that, Winter's Bone would have been very high on my list had I seen it before I made my list. But the lists are a moment in time exercise, right? Like, it's just, what did I think at that exact moment when I wrote the list?
Yeah, but I'm writing the list now, and I have no idea where I think, because, all these movies bring something different to the table that are in my top 10 or top 5. Zero Dark Thirty is a completely different type of experience than, say, Holy Motors. And, Holy Motors gives me something that maybe Zero Dark Thirty doesn't, but it's also true the other way around. So it's difficult. I mean, Zero Dark Thirty is a satisfying narrative film, and Holy Motors is something much more abstract than that. But Holy Motors is... provides a different type of beauty and a different type of performance. Who, I guess, Denis Levant, I'm sure I'm saying his name wrong. Yeah, he's French.
Denis, I have no idea how it's pronounced.
He's fantastic, and he should be nominated for everything in the world because he plays, I think, 11 characters in this movie, and he's great in all of them.
It's insane how you can literally watch him put on the makeup to play the character and then just disappear into it. Like, It's a feat of phenomenal acting to watch him A, playing an actor, and B, like, literally putting on the costume and becoming the character. It's a beautiful thing to watch. And especially, like, some of the characters he plays, the troll character he plays in the Eva Mendes portion of the film is just so out there, and he just goes for it so thoroughly. It's quite a sight.
And it kind of made me think about just the process of sitting down and watching a movie. Every time you go to the movies, you kind of have to remove yourself from reality, not just, knowing that what's on the screen is false, but kind of trying to forget that the actors are actors, or if it's a famous actor, it's, oh, it's this person. Oh, it's Christian Bale, or oh, it's Jessica Chastain. There's kind of a process that everybody goes through when they sit down and watch a movie, that they have to kind of remove themselves from that type of reality. And I think in Holy Motors, you see this actor character and you're traveling around with them. And as you go from scene to scene and movie to movie within the story, you know that this is the actor playing the actor, but at the same time, you kind of forget and you kind of have to remove yourself. And each time it's kind of hitting the refresh button, like you're going to see another movie.
And it's amazing how fluidly he transitions to the point that I completely did every time, you know. I was never thinking about, oh, the actor is doing, like, the actor in the movie is doing such a great job.
Yeah, I think the only times where it was kind of tough was when it was purposefully ambiguous. I'm talking about the scene with Kylie Minogue, which is very ambiguous as to what is part of the movie and what is part of this world
that they're leading.
Exactly. And we won't spoil anything there, but...
Oh, yeah, I think Holy Motors would be impossible to spoil. But
oh, I could spoil it if I tell you what. I could spoil it very easily. I mean, it's not, again, it's not a narrative movie. The spoiler would be telling you things that happen in the movie that would surprise you.
But I think the less you know going in, the better. So the less we say about it, the better. I would say.
I agree. I would say.
But go see this movie. It's the most unique movie you'll see this year. I can't say that it will be number one on my list. I have no idea yet. But it's certainly in consideration for the top slot, and it's. Yeah, I would say it's hands down the most unique movie I saw this year, and probably for the last several years.
Yeah, and it's a great movie to kind of, after you're seeing it, sit down with a friend and talk about it. It's one of those type of movies. It's great.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So we probably have time to talk about one more, I would say, before we gotta wrap this up.
Do you want to do two more or one more?
Let's do two more.
You're about to just make me pick my number one movie of the year.
We'll do two more. So, which one do you want to do first? I assume I know which two we're going to be talking about.
We're going to talk about Beasts of the Southern Wild, and we're going to talk about The Master.
Yeah, those are exactly the two that I wanted to talk about. I didn't want to shortchange Beasts, but I was gonna probably pick The Master to talk about if we had to pick, which probably says something about where those two will rank, I guess. But I have no idea if that will hold out by the end of the week. This is a really hard list to write, guys.
It is really hard.
So why don't we talk about Beasts of the Southern Wild first?
Sure, let's talk about it. This is a movie, you know, the reason it's going to be high up on my list, and because I have like an affinity towards movies that are kind of based in fairy tale and fantasy, and movies that can do that for adults and could pull that off well. They tend to stick with me just because it kind of, you know, it delivers narratively, but it also delivers. It's usually, I'm talking generally here, something that's a little bit more interesting to me visually. Movies like Pan's Labyrinth, which is my favorite movie of all time, or not my favorite movie of all time, but
favorite movies. But your favorite movie of all time is also a fantasy.
My real favorite movie of all time, Brazil, is kind of in a similar vein. But Brazil is one of my favorite movies of all time. And Beasts of the Southern Wild. It's completely different than those two movies, but it does fit into this kind of fantasy world, and it's kind of a new fantasy. It's a fantasy that kind of exists in the modern day, but kind of doesn't. It kind of exists in America, but kind of doesn't. And it's just interesting to kind of parse over the beauty of this movie. I think it was absolutely stunning movie to look at. I think we're not going to say the actress's name, but I'm going to use TV parlance here, but like the cold opening of the movie, the opening credits sequence is maybe my favorite thing that I saw on a screen this year, period. Television, movies, whatever. It was like the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. Oh, it was absolutely gorgeous.
But also at the same time, it's a very simple movie with unbelievably strong performances from people who are not professional actors, at least up until this movie.
And, I mean, we talked about Moonrise Kingdom, the kids being good. The girl who plays the main character, Hush Puppy, again, I'm not going to try to say her name because I have no idea how it's pronounced, but she was just phenomenal. I mean, she was one of the best performances I've seen this year in anything. Was given by, she's what, I think 7?
Yeah, something like that. Or she might have been even younger than that when they filmed the movie.
Yeah, she was like 5, 6, 7, somewhere in that area when they made the movie. And she is just incredible.
Yeah, I think, and also, you know, we talk about some of the great directors that have made the movies on this list. But Ben Zeitlin, I think that's how you pronounce his name.
I believe so.
He's kind of the most impressive to me. One, because he was able to get this type of performance out of an actress so young. And it was such a moving performance to me. That he was, not only he was able to get that out, but it was such a beautiful movie to look at. And he wrote it. And he, I think, co-composed the music to it, which is, it also had, I think, the best music.
The score of that movie is like, the main theme of that movie will give me goosebumps every single time I hear it. I've been meaning to download that so I can have it on my iPod.
I do. I like the music to run to it. It is great running music.
The music is just beautiful in the movie. And it's one of those scores I think that's like phenomenally good, but not distracting from the movie, which some of the all-time great film scores are a little bit distracting, I think, because they're just so great that it kind of takes you out of it. And that, it never did, despite the fact that I left that movie going like, wow, that score was just incredible. But across the board, I think virtually everything about the movie is done very, very well. It's very well directed. It's very well written. It's very well acted by, like you said, people who were not actors until this movie. It's got a great sense of place, and especially because the place it is depicting does not exist.
It does not exist, but it feels like it exists.
It does. It feels like a place that should be real.
And I think it was filmed in Louisiana, so you know, it definitely has that feel to it.
Well, it was filmed in Louisiana. I mean, it takes place in Louisiana, quote unquote.
Yeah, in a non-existent part of Louisiana.
Right. Exactly.
I think this the movie it didn't necessarily have it wasn't. A strong narrative push. It was kind of a lot of little things going on. Hush Puppy's dad is sick, and she's also looking for her lost mother, and they're also dealing with this kind of great mythical flood, while these beasts, these kind of, you know,
there
beasts
are,
from a storybook.
Right, yeah,
there are beasts of the Southern Wild. There's this kind of ongoing threat coming towards them that we don't know about. It's very abstract also with its story. Not to the extent that Holy Motors is, but this
no, but
is...
it's. I mean, it's more. It's a fantasy, you know. It's like I think the best way to put it is exactly what you said. It's not a strong narrative movie. It does have a story. It's not like Holy Motors, which sort of has a story and sort of doesn't. It definitely has a story, but it's more a series of vignettes, I would say.
Yeah, it's kind of a journey story, and it's really about Hush Puppy's journey, and that the movie could kind of put the weight of all of this on her, and some extremely weighty things. I mean, dealing with a lost mother and dealing with her father's health and dealing with disaster in her small town. And this little girl has to kind of go through all of these things.
Yeah.
It's not a weepy performance. It's not something where it's just seeing all the, it's not masochistic. It's not just seeing all these terrible things that can happen to this poor girl.
No,
it's not like that. It's kind of about strength and her strength and her father's strength.
She is a fierce little girl, and she is just, it's an incredibly powerful performance. She's, you know, she's funny. She's emotional. She's really, it's one of, if not my favorite performance of the year. And it came from a 6-year-old girl, which is just even more impressive. And I think, Zetlin deserves a lot of credit for getting that performance out of her. And just, I mean, this movie is phenomenally well directed. It's probably, if not my favorite piece of direction this year, then my second favorite. And I think that would go back and forth with The Master as well, with Paul Thomas Anderson's just phenomenal work as a director that we're going to talk about in a minute. But Beasts of the Southern Wilds was just, I think magical realism is the term that I would throw at it, and it does it so well, and It's just a great piece of filmmaking across the board.
Yeah, I agree. And it's definitely a movie where you're going to be left with the images. I mean, they're so beautiful throughout this movie.
That movie is, there are scenes in that movie that have just stuck in my head all year. It came out, that also came out this summer, because I saw that with you as well.
Yes, another summer movie, another summer blockbuster.
But it was, The Avengers and Beasts of the Southern Wild. But it was, it stuck with me. You know, the long stretches of that movie are just imprinted on my brain. It's so beautiful.
And I think, you know, if this movie gets a bunch of Oscar nominations, which I think it will, I'd encourage everyone who hasn't seen it to go see it, because I assume they'll probably want to re-release it.
It's going to be re-released because it'll probably get a lot of award nominations.
And the actress,
go see the movie.
Yeah, the actress, she will get a lot of attention because she's so young and she deserves it.
I really hope that she gets some awards, because oftentimes they give the young actress the token nomination and think that's enough because they're so young. But she's just incredible in that movie.
Yeah. I don't want to spend too much time on award stuff, but I can see her getting nominated, but I cannot see her winning because I have a feeling Oscar is going to be much more sympathetic to Anne Hathaway, who is Anne Hathaway, and they're going to give it to her.
But the question is whether Hathaway will be in a supporting actress as opposed to actress.
Oh, I think she's probably going to be... I don't know.
Her character is supporting. Well, we'll talk about this. I'm sure we're going to do an Oscars podcast at some point.
We will definitely do an Oscars podcast.
So we'll talk about that later. For now, why don't we transition and talk about The Master, and then we can close this thing down.
You want to start with The Master? What did you like about The Master? What did you not like about The Master?
Well, Paul Thomas Anderson is probably my favorite director working right now. I mean, every movie he makes is pretty much across the board incredible. And The Master is probably his most difficult movie yet, I would say. I only saw it once and I wanted to see it at least two or three times just because there's so much there. There's just... You know, it's a world's worth of things are happening in this movie, and you could analyze it from any angle, and there's just a ton there. The basic premise, for those of you who haven't seen it, Joaquin Phoenix is a soldier who's come back from World War II, and he falls in with he's a cult leader, but the thinker and cult leader is the only thing I can really say, Philip Seymour Hoffman, who is...
He's a philosopher.
Sure, he's a theoretical philosopher, as he says.
Yeah.
It is based in part on Scientology, which is what's gotten the most attention, the idea that Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is based on L. Ron Hubbard, but that really, I think, is one of the least interesting things about the movie, and it's really not the focus, you know, this is not at all the veiled Scientology movie, it's really a movie about the relationship between Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix, and the power dynamics between the two of them, and their sort of struggle for control of one another, and their struggle for influence in one another's lives, and it's just... It's an epic movie. It's an epic in close-up, is what I would say. Like, there are a lot of close-ups in this movie, and it's a really close look at these two characters, but it still feels like an epic struggle and, like, just epic across the board.
Yeah, I think the word you use, struggle, I think that's kind of the center of the movie. When I think about the movie, like you said, you can't just... I think you'll be a little bit disappointed if you're thinking about whether this will be a biopic of Scientology, just without using the people's names. This is really about a struggle between a master and someone who is seen as an animal. And I think Paul Thomas Anderson kind of plays with this power struggle and how, you know, Joaquin Phoenix doesn't want to need a master, but he kind of keeps going back. And it's that dynamic that's played with over the course of, I guess it takes place over months. I don't know.
It takes place over years.
Years?
About an 8-year period that the movie takes place over. Because, I mean, it ends in the 50s. And I think
there was a big jump later in the movie.
I guess maybe there's just a giant jump. But I would say it takes place over the course of at least a year or two in these characters' lives. It's not explicitly clear and obviously not all that important. But it's a long stretch of time.
Yeah, and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix, they're... Together, their presence on screen is increased tenfold. One of the most suspenseful, kind of almost scary, scenes is when he's auditing, or what do they call it?
Processing, I think it's
process. Yeah, they're processing. Joaquin Phoenix's character. It's intensely personal. And that's captured, of course, in close-ups. But there is this closeness between the two. You know, you can talk about any homoerotic undertones in the movie between the two. But that there's this kind of... They clash, they kind of hate each other, but they also kind of need each other. It's this great dynamic between the two. And I think that's really the focus of The Master, as opposed to anything having to do with, you know, Scientology explicitly.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think there are two or three, maybe even four scenes that are in the movie that are long scenes that are just the two of them. And every one of them is incredible. And they're both phenomenal. And I should say, I also have a bit of an acting bias against Joaquin Phoenix. I've never thought he was particularly great. But he is just phenomenal in The Master. I mean... 100% turn me around on him. He's so good. And Philip Seymour Hoffman, who I love, is also incredible. So, I mean, Amy Adams is also very good, I should say. really, it's well acted across the board, and this is another one that's it's just well done in virtually every way that a movie can be well done, I think, which is sort of the stock in trade for Paul Thomas Anderson. You know, he just makes phenomenal movies. And perhaps, I think the only one that you could argue is Punch Drunk Love is not perhaps on the level, and I think that it is, but a lot of people do not.
I like Punch Drunk Love a lot.
He just makes great movies. The Master is another great movie. And it's one that, as soon as it's available to me on Blu-ray, I'll be buying it, and I will be watching it many more times, because I really feel like I love the movie now, and it's very possibly going to be, you know, it'll be very high on my list, very possibly my number one movie of the year when I write this list. And I think I'm going to love it so much more when I've seen it several more times and I've let it sink in a little bit.
Yeah, I think this, and I'm sure I think a few other movies probably on our favorites list, they're going to do a lot better on repeat viewings. Just there's so much to absorb here, especially in The Master. Mm-hmm. And just little things in these performances. Joaquin Phoenix's face. I mean, just little ticks and things are perfect.
It's a phenomenal performance. It's really almost titanic in how fantastic he is, and not the movie, obviously.
Of course, you mean he's like Leonardo DiCaprio in Titanic.
Yeah, he's pretty much Kate Winslet in Titanic.
Yes.
He's the boat, guys.
He is the boat.
Yeah, he's that good. Yeah, so The Master is fantastic. There were a lot of great movies this year. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap this bad boy up?
Be on the lookout for our top 10 list, where we actually have a real order to these and we can maybe more coherently talk about why we like them so much. And
yeah, my list will talk about the movies that are on it far better than I was able to tonight when I've sat down and put some thought into it, as opposed to just talking out of my ass.
Yeah. And hopefully, you know, we both have a few movies that we need to kind of wait and see, because they either haven't come out yet or we just haven't gotten around to them. I know movies that I want to see that I haven't yet, The Hobbit, Les Mis, which hasn't come out as of the recording of this, and Django, which also hasn't come out yet.
Yeah.
Hopefully those will be good and will vie for a spot on our lists. And if they don't,
I need to see Amor. I need to see The Loneliest Planet. So I've got my work cut out for me in the next few days before I have to write this bad boy. And some of those will almost certainly make my list. And also This Is 40, which I'm seeing very soon after I get finished recording this podcast. So some of those might make my list. And sorry I didn't talk about them, because I haven't seen them yet.
Yeah, deal with it.
Go check out our lists at reviewname.com, as always. You can tell us what you think of the podcast, what you think of our lists in the comments on the website. You can follow us on Twitter at reviewbenamed. You can email us at reviewbenamed@gmail.com. This is concluding our Best of Film podcast. I believe we'll be, by the time our next podcast comes out, it will be the new year. So I guess I should do the new year sign off now, but we're going to record one more podcast within this year. So you'll hear me talk about the end of the year and then be my big gushy year end self on next week's podcast, which I should also announce, we're going to be back on Tuesdays, our regularly scheduled time, starting next week, now that the Best of 2012 stuff is done. So yay. I hope you've enjoyed all of our Best of 2012 podcasts. And we will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.